Amanda DeGuio was a 24-year-old from Upper Darby Township in Pennsylvania. She was the mother of two and had just come back from a Disney family vacation. Sometime between June 3rd and June 7th of 2014, she left her home. Amanda would leave home for a few days at a time, but would always return. This time, she was never seen again. I'm Ed Densel, and this is Unfound. If you're a member of the Unfound Podcast discussion group on Facebook, you already know today's episode is going to be a little different. First, we're talking to a private investigator, and a very good one at that, and that's a first. Also, we're talking about a few disappearances in this episode, instead of just concentrating on one like we usually do. So as the title says, we're kind of stepping out and leaving the regular format. However, the title also means something else. We're talking about three cases in this episode, but in two of them, women stepped out for what was supposed to be just a short time, but they never came back. In Amanda's case, she had a habit of leaving for a few days, but always returned. In the other, in Crystal Morrison's disappearance, which we'll cover to a little lesser extent, she stepped out from work, she wasn't feeling well, she called a friend to pick her up. By the time this friend arrived, Crystal was gone. And now a summary of Amanda's case. On May 27th, 2014, 24-year-old Amanda DeGuio and her family returned to Pennsylvania from a fun family trip to Disney World. After this trip, she was having a much more positive outlook toward her future. She spoke of getting a new job, getting her teeth fixed, among other changes. For the last few years, she'd been gripped by a pill addiction. However, between 7 and 10 days later, Amanda disappeared from her mother's home in the Drexel Hill section of Upper Darby Township, where she lived with her girls who were staying with their fathers that day. Amanda didn't take her credit cards or any extra clothing, and the family hasn't heard from her since. Amanda would sometimes leave home for a few days at a time, but she would always call family to check in. Along with her addiction, she was possibly involved in prostitution, posting on sites such as Backpage using the names Jonna, Ariana, and Crystal. Yet she always returned home and showed no signs of being abused. Although there have been several reported sightings of Amanda from such places as a pharmacy and an apartment complex, none of these sightings have been confirmed despite the media saying otherwise. So officially, Amanda has not been seen since the June 3rd to June 7th of 2014 timeframe. The interview for this episode is with the representative for the DeGuio family, private investigator Kevin Ryan. Unfound news. I'm not sure if it's going to be this month or next month, and I don't want to jinx it at this point, but Unfound is going to cover a case very much like the first one that this program ever aired back in September of 2016. That's all I can say at this point. I guess you'd call that a hint. All of you can talk amongst yourselves to figure out what disappearance it might be. Next, and while I'm at it, I might as well give you some other hints, and these concern the special episode that you'll be able to download once the Unfound website is up and running. This case has been covered on several podcasts and on Disappeared. There is video evidence in the case. The man's car was recovered, but this person is still missing. Those are your hints. You'll find out later why I picked that case to be the special one. And finally, Unfound is going on the road come the end of July. I'm driving to Pennsylvania, taking all of my podcast stuff with me to see my parents for about a month. I don't predict any problem in continuing to put out episodes every Friday while I'm there, and I hope to meet a couple of the guests who have been on Unfound while I'm in Pennsylvania. I'm really looking forward to that. Where you can find Unfound? On Twitter, at Unfound Podcast. The email address, unfoundpodcast@gmail.com. On Instagram, at Unfound Podcast. On YouTube, do a search for the Unfound Podcast channel. on Facebook, the Unfound Podcast Discussion Group. You can subscribe to Unfound at Podomatic and iTunes. And please mention Unfound to all your friends and neighbors, along with spreading the word on Web Sleuths, Reddit, podcasts we listen to, and all other true crime websites and forums. I'm so happy to have on this episode of Unfound private investigator Kevin Ryan. Kevin, welcome to Unfound.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Kevin, tell the listeners a little bit about yourself, and then we'll go into how you got involved in Amanda DeGuio's disappearance.
Sure. I've been in the industry since 2001, and I broke in with insurance fraud and the white-collar crime, and within the last 10 years, I've gotten involved in missing persons and investigating for the families of missing family members, and I've had numerous cases and nationwide, and it's been cases that are cold, some that are fluid in the sense that they're recent, and each case has a story, and each missing person deserves a voice. So that's what I'm here for.
Did you used to be a policeman? Any law enforcement experience or your background? What got you into this?
I have a little bit of law enforcement experience, but I've always been more involved with the private investigation side. Giving somebody else closure or resolution, whether it is fraud, investigating whether or not that people are on the up and up. I always wanted to stay on the private side of things. So that was my, I've always felt that was my niche.
You mentioned you've been doing this for a while, and we're going to mention a couple other cases besides Amanda's after we really get deep into her disappearance. But can you name some of those other cases, maybe some cases maybe that people have heard of, or maybe a couple that got resolved in the last 10 years that you might have been connected to in some way that
sure.
comes to mind?
Sure. We had my first case was Jake Ziegler and Ray Pierce out of Charlotte, North Carolina. That was a case where they both went missing on their way to Myrtle Beach from Charlotte. They were ultimately and unfortunately found deceased 2 weeks later, halfway between Charlotte and Myrtle Beach as a result of a vehicle accident. Brittany Drexel, that's a pretty popular case. She went missing in 2009 out of Myrtle Beach. I was involved in that a little bit, more so her mother, Dawn, started a nonprofit organization called Brittany's Little Angels, and I was a director of investigations for that. That was a nonprofit organization that provided support and advocacy for families of missing people. Crystal Prentice Morrison, that is another case out of Concord, North Carolina. That was also 2012. I was involved with that one. Where she went missing from her work. She has not been found, and that case still remains open. Of course, Amanda DeGuio here in Philadelphia, that case remains open and very active investigation-wise. Another big one in the Philadelphia area was Ryan Sedak out of Pottstown area. Unfortunately, we just found him 3 weeks ago deceased, and we're still investigating the circumstances of that disappearance. I had another one in New York, Jennifer Ramsaran. That was 4 years ago. Unfortunately, she was found deceased, and her husband was ultimately charged with murder.
So what you're telling the listeners is you have an extensive experience in disappearances, all different types of disappearances, some that have been solved and some that are still open with a wide range of, facts in these cases.
Yeah. And for me, Ed, it's all about the families. It's mm-hmm. providing a service to the families that they normally would not be able to receive from law enforcement. because law enforcement has other cases on their dockets, obviously, whereas I can dedicate my team, my investigators who are trained, to the families themselves in a professional and personal manner. And best part about our services is we do not charge for our services. Everything we do is pro bono. And that is one thing that the families can rest assured that they will be taken care of no matter what.
Great. Thank you for that. Let's move to Amanda DeGuia's disappearance. How did you get involved in that case? And then we'll go into some of the facts.
Sure. So Amanda DeGuia was missing in June of 2014. I got involved in April of 2015. Her father called me and asked me if I would be able to lend assistance to the family in her disappearance. So he called me, we met, and then we discussed the facts of the case at that point.
What would you say the state of the investigation was in? So you came in approximately, not quite a year later. What would you say the state of the investigation was in at that point?
With the state of the investigation, we were on our second detective with the law enforcement agency. And I met with him. We were interviewing people. We combined an investigation together. I on the private side, him on the law enforcement side, and we kept each other in the loop with what we were doing. Ultimately, as a missing person investigator, you want to establish that bond with the law enforcement agency so that information can be shared and knowledge is known throughout the investigation. At that point in time, we had not had a credible sighting of her since pretty much she went missing. There had been sightings, but nothing added up to this is definitely where Amanda is. This is definitely where Amanda was. And the only time you can ever get a credible sighting that I believe is on a camera.
Everything else is just hearsay.
To me, yes. And maybe not everybody else, but I want to know 100% that this was Amanda or that this is the missing person.
Because it does seem like I've been doing this for about 10 months. Once in a while, you do have people who seems like they want to, as witnesses, infuse themselves into the story, saying that they saw this missing person somewhere. Then you go there and, like you say, see a videotape, and there's no record of that person ever being there. I'm amazed how much that happens.
Right. So what you have, Ed, is you have people out there that want to be a hero. There's never one hero in bringing a missing person home, because it's a collaborative effort. And a lot of times, I always say it takes good old-fashioned police work. And that's hitting the pounding the pavements, boots on the ground, interviewing, things of that nature. Well, you can't just put one investigator on these missing person cases, but there's always one or two people that want to be that hero. And that's what makes things difficult, because they always have what we call self-gain in that. And it doesn't work. It just throws us off in different directions. So we kind of filter the information that comes in and decipher what we're going to use and what we're going to prioritize in our investigation.
So what did you learn when you got involved? What did you hear about? What was going on in Amanda's life when she disappeared? Who was she? And what was going on around the time that she disappeared, and specifically that day she disappeared? I know that, you know, there's still some uncertainties about when she actually disappeared, at what time, and all that. What can you tell the listeners about all of that?
So Amanda was the mother of two children, two little girls, beautiful girls. And Amanda just pretty much disappeared one day. She left her house, and we're not sure if she was picked up, if she was abducted, if she walked away. We're not sure what happened. But we do know the obvious, she hasn't returned. So trying to build a profile on Amanda and what she was doing during that time has been difficult, but in the same sense has helped us with where we think her mind was at that point in time. So putting together a profile on a missing person is very, very important. Putting together their last known whereabouts and their attitude and their demeanor and who they were with and what they were doing pretty much will tell what went on in those final days before they went missing.
She was, from what I've read, and we the listeners should know that Kevin and I had a prior conversation just as to, you know, what we were going to talk about. She had just gone on a vacation with her family, come back, but she had been, I think, a recovering drug addict, had some issues here, but her family was under the impression that she had beaten those demons. But maybe you think maybe that wasn't so. And I'm also wondering, that day that she disappeared, was she home by herself or was she with her kids? Or did she just kind of like what they thought she was coming back and didn't? Or what, you know, what can you tell us about that?
So they did return from a trip about a week prior from Disney World. They would take the kids to the whole family would take the kids to Disney World once or twice a year. And they did return from that trip. Amanda did battle some addiction issues. And it is safe to say that she was probably battling some addiction issues when she went missing. Based on my investigation and my interviews, that's where a lot of people we've talked to have led us in that direction. We don't just assume that somebody's an addict because they were in the past. Meaning we don't assume that they're still involved in that addiction. I understand that, you know, addiction is a difficult demon to beat, and there's always that piece that's there. But I never just assume that they're still doing the drugs or still involved in the addiction just because they went missing. It could be a precursor to why they went missing. It could be, you know, something of that nature. But all the interviews that I've done say that she still had the addiction and she was still battling it when she went missing. As for when she went missing, you know, where there were people that were looking for her, family members and police that were looking for her from June until August, but not in a manner that she was reported missing. So with that being said, our last time that we know that she was around was on or about June 5th or 6th, 2014. And that's based on cell phone records, cell phone pings, things of that nature. She was ultimately reported missing in August of 14.
So like 2 months later.
Right.
And that certainly hurt no matter what, that always hurts an investigation, right? I mean, time is a killer.
Yeah, time is always of the essence, and when you have a 2 month lag like that, it just really sets everything back because, you know, in Amanda's case, you know, you never know. Okay, we don't have a body right now, okay, but we don't have any activity either, so we're not sure what happened. However, when it comes to that lag time of not reporting her and getting her in NamUs and getting her reported as missing or endangered, you know, a lot of people think, well, maybe she just went off on a binge or maybe she ran away for a little while or things of that nature. She did not have a history of running away. I think the longest she's ever been away was 2 or 3 days. And that was with friends or family or things like that, but always kept in contact with some sort of family members.
So that day that she disappeared, nobody saw her leave. She wasn't at home with anybody, then left, or she was with her kids. I'm just wondering, what did the family think? Did they think that she was just stepping out, or was she by herself when she left the house? Do you know? Do you know?
When Amanda left, she just pretty much just left the house. I believe that the kids were in the house, and her mother was at home. And she, like anything else, she's an adult. She walked out of the house and she was never seen again. And that's where the $30 million question is what happened?
Yeah. Did she take anything with her? You said her cell phone, but other things that led you to believe she was going to be gone for a while? Or what is also missing besides herself?
She had her cell phone and that was pretty much it. she didn't take, she didn't have any clothes with her. She didn't have any overnight bags that I know of.
Take her purse with her?
I believe she did have a purse with her. I believe she had her purse. I think she had a couple credit cards. I think she had her ID on her.
Now, what motivated the DeGuio family to get you involved with this approximately, you know, a year later, something like that? And what did you do, first of all, when you got involved?
So when I get involved in cases, it's just like any other case, Amanda's being the same, is I have, it's just an extra set of eyes. It's an extra set of eyes on the case. It has nothing to do with somebody not doing their job or doing their job too much or focusing in on one area. It's an extra set of eyes on the case to shed light on what could have happened in response to a family member's request. When I first got called, I met with Amanda's biological father. Amanda's parents are divorced, and I met with Amanda's father. We went over the circumstances of the case. Everything that he knew about it leading up to my entrance and subsequent involvement. We talked about the type of person that she is. We talked about the type of person she was before she went missing. We talked about how much she loved her children, how much she loved taking them to Walt Disney World, her as a student, even in grade school, going to high school. She was a very popular person. And in missing person cases, that there's always 1% of missing people that go missing that are loners. And she did not fit in that percentile. She was a very popular person. As I said before, she had a lot of friends, her Facebook page, a lot of followers, so I knew at that point that, obviously, I'm a year into this, and I needed to hit the ground running and start interviewing people all over again. After I met with the father, I then called the police department that was the lead agency on the case. I introduced myself to the detective, and the detective was very, very cordial and immediately met with me, opened the case file, showed me what he had. And I told him my plan was to start interviewing people that they have already interviewed, and they were fine with everything. So that's pretty much what we've been doing since then, is re-interviewing people, re-interviewing them again, because if you reach out to that one person or that one group that may have seen something, may have known something, they could lead us in the direction we need to go.
Now, as you do this, are you keeping your mind very open as you were working through Amanda's case, or did it very quickly, once you started interviewing some of these people, and you don't have to tell the people who you interviewed, that's fine. Did you quickly come down to like one theory, or are there still a couple theories that you're working on in this case?
So, Ed, when you do investigations for missing people, you start with the family themselves, the immediate family, and then you branch your way out. In missing person cases, nobody is ever ruled out, including mom, dad, siblings, grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, best friends, spouses. So in Amanda's case, we started very close, and then we started to work our way out and work our way out. And we would get information from people that would give us more people to interview. So you have to go into these things with an open mind, okay? And knowing that Amanda had addiction issues, you can't just say, oh, this is just another druggie that went missing and it's dead somewhere. Never in my mind did I ever think that, mm-hmm. or would I say that to anybody. In right. Amanda's case, I knew that we were looking for somebody that we needed to pluck from an area where she could be in some sort of trouble. I don't believe, and to this day, I don't believe we're dealing with a suicide. That just was not Amanda's mentality. That was not who she was. And that is not what she was like when she went missing. So with that being said, we've gone in different directions. There's been sightings in areas in Philadelphia. At that point, you branch out based on the information you get. But when you're interviewing people, you've got to sort through the facts of what people are telling you and the truth based on the same person saying the same thing and the next person saying the same thing and the person after that. And that's what you go on. But we go with the direction the evidence leads us.
Did you happen to question the father of Amanda's children?
Yes. Amanda has two children, as I stated before, and two different fathers. Both of those fathers have been questioned. And like I said, nobody's ever ruled out.
Hmm.
And that includes them, that includes her family, that includes everybody.
Now, this is an area where she disappeared that you're kind of familiar with it, aren't you, personally?
I am. So the area she disappeared from was Upper Darby, Pennsylvania. It's a middle-class area, blue-collar working people there in that area. It's about a couple miles just outside of West Philadelphia. And through based on investigation and interviewing, it's taken us to the Kensington section of Philadelphia, which is not a nice area. There's a lot of drugs, a lot of prostitution, a lot of illicit activity going on. And that's where we've been focusing our attention and not ruling out other places. But we've been focusing in on that area, that general area.
Was that an area that while Amanda was doing drugs that she might frequent once in a while, or that would have been an area that she would have never come across in her life unless she was actually taken there, to your knowledge?
That would have been an area where you would grab an addict would gravitate toward, in the sense that it's easy to get drugs in that area. It's easy to get whatever type of fix you need. If in fact Amanda was battling her addiction issues, she didn't take a bus down there. She was taken there. You don't just get off a bus and just start going places. You have to pretty much know the lay of the land from what we gathered in interviewing people. I learned more about that area with this case than I did with any other case. And that's pretty much what we have been told. Now, if that's different, if Amanda's situation is different and she knew where she was going, that's news to us. But I can honestly say, talking to her family, that she pretty much hung out in that Upper Darby area. And like any other area, you have your drug activity and things of that nature. But the interviews in that area gravitated us toward the Kensington area as well.
Now, in this case, sex trafficking has also come up. And that's something that you are very knowledgeable on. What can you tell the listeners about that, how that all works, and how that might be related to Amanda's case?
So sex trafficking is a big, big organization. And it's not just in the United States. It's all over the world. And in a situation like that, sex trafficking, you have organized and you have unorganized groups. There are organized groups in Philadelphia. There are unorganized groups in Philadelphia. A lot of the organized groups are in the Kensington section because that is a big prostitution and drug area. When a person is trafficked or they are led into this world, they're going to be quickly sent as far away as they can be from the area they are trafficked because of, obviously, law enforcement and media coverage. The black market, we call it, they can be sold for hundreds of thousands of dollars. That is a possibility in this case. That is a big possibility. It's not one that we've ever taken off the table. And it's one that we have looked at. But the more that time goes by and the more interviewing that we're doing, we don't believe that that's the direction we need to be going in.
I don't want you to get into any specifics that could compromise the investigation, but in general, what would be those kinds of things that would lead you toward that and things that would lead you away from that? Because, you know, I, of course, have been doing this program for about 10 months now, and there have been a couple cases where it is believed maybe this young woman got sex trafficked. The one that comes right off the top of my head is Jessie Foster, who disappeared in Las Vegas, and her mother is in Canada. She's a Canadian citizen fighting against human trafficking that goes on between Canada and the United States. But how would somebody from the outside maybe look at that and say, okay, this woman over here was probably sex trafficked, but this one who disappeared, but this other one over here, this was just a more of a, I guess you'd say, a regular abduction where rape and murder was just the motive. Is that something that you really have to dig deep into before you know?
Yeah, you have to, because a lot of people think that when a 24-year-old girl goes missing, it's all of a sudden sex trafficking. And that's not the case. That's not always the case. Mm-hmm. And as an investigator, you need to dig into that theory, especially for the family and more so for yourself in getting answers. When we look into the sex trafficking end of things, we look at the area that she was last seen in. We look at the people that she was last with, if we know that. And we look at the interviewing certain people that she's an acquaintance to and who may or may not have told us where she was hanging out and what she was doing. So it's never 100% shot that this person was trafficked or whatever. So in Amanda's case, we know that she was last seen in Upper Darby. Well, that area, to my knowledge, today, there was no organized sex trafficking rings in that area. Now, that's not to say that an organized ring came driving through Philly like the circus and just started rounding people up. But it's just highly unlikely, based on some interviews that, you know, we do have people that said they were with her. We do have people that say they saw her in the Kensington area up until, I know we have one in January of 2016, that said that they saw her in Kensington. It hasn't been 100% confirmed, but we have certain... we have certain things in our investigation that we talk to people about that only we know about Amanda that would tell us if that person is being accurate, truthful, or just doesn't know, that we're not leaking out to the general public.
Yeah, of course. Just one more thing about the cell phone. What did the cell phone information tell you? If you can tell that to listeners, if that's okay to say. What did the cell phone information from around her time of her disappearance say?
So, and what I'll do is I'll go into how a cell phone helps out an investigation in a missing person case, and I'll briefly touch on Amanda's.
Okay.
What we look for is your last calls, your last outgoing text messages, any activity that the missing person performed. Incoming is good, but outgoing is better. Because after a person goes missing or after a phone is lost, the incoming messages, if they don't get answered, then we know we have an issue. So we look for, again, last phone calls, last phone outbound text messages, any type of Googling on the network, or anything of that nature. And then what we do is we ping the phone, and that ping, when we ping a phone, that'll tell us the last location of that phone, which is very important. When I say that phone, doesn't mean the person is with that phone. So it can be very good information, or it can be very deceiving information. When a cell phone hits a tower, it generally goes from one tower to the next, to the next, to the next, and it bounces off signals. When it doesn't go to the next tower, generally, that phone either shut off in that area or is in that area. And it can be from 1,000 meters to 500 meters to 2,500 meters. You're going to find something usually in that area when it comes to a cell phone. In Amanda's case, we have cell phone activity in early June, that pretty much just dies off. And I'm not going to get into the areas where the phone is pinged to, its last location of the phone, but it doesn't mean that Amanda was in that location. It means her phone had pinged there and her phone was there. So that's very, very important to the listeners, that just because you have a last known location of the phone doesn't mean that the missing person, or in Amanda's case, Amanda was with that phone.
And the other point that you made is just because a cell phone pings off a particular tower, that doesn't mean that phone is sitting right beside the tower. It could be a quarter of a mile away or a half mile away. You just don't know. And then once you figure that that's a circle, you know, that, I mean, we're talking square miles here by that point.
Correct. And we, and again, with back to Amanda's records herself, we have spoken with pretty much everybody on that call log and that texting log. And through that, we've developed information that, you know, that in the investigation has taken us in different areas. And like I said, we focus in on that Kensington area, but we've been through other areas outside the Kensington area as well that we've talked to some people, and nothing has panned out there. So it's an open investigation. It's active. It's not one that we're going to give up on. It's not one law enforcement's given up on. Law enforcement has put a lot of time and effort into this case, and we're in it till there's a resolution.
That's good, dear. How is Amanda's family handling it? And the listeners should know it was Amanda's family who actually put me in touch with Kevin. I've only had a very limited conversation with them. Kevin has been doing most of the speaking for them. How have they been handling this?
They've been handling it pretty well. As time goes on, everybody thinks where Amanda could be. Is she dead? Is she alive? I have told the family just up until this week, I still don't believe we're looking for a body. I believe we're still looking for Amanda. Until that changes, that's my theory. They've got good days. They've got bad days. They have Amanda's children to keep them up, to keep them, you know, upbeat and positive energy. But like anybody else that's going through this saga and ordeal, they have their bad days.
Amanda's family does have a Facebook page. It's called Help Find Amanda DeGuio. I hope all of the listeners go there to find out more about her disappearance. Do you know of any other ways, Kevin, that do they have a website or anything else like that? We're not going to give out, of course, their phone number, but is that probably the best way if people want to go and find out more of their about Amanda's disappearance and how to help? Do you think that's the best way? On top of contacting you, of course.
Yeah, we have, we've kept it to just the Facebook page, Help Find Amanda DeGuio, as you said. That will give updates on information on the investigation. Any information that anybody has can post on there. I monitor it regularly, so does law enforcement. So we see what comes in there, and we act on every lead that comes in, every tip. If you have a tip, we'll call you back right away. So that's one thing that you can definitely look at is to Help Find Amanda DeGuio page.
Let's touch on quickly a couple other cases that you've been involved in very quickly, not as in-depth as we went into Amanda's case, but one that I'm sure people know very, very well, and then another one, to my knowledge, they may probably don't know very well. Let's talk about the well-known one first. Brittany Drexel. What can you tell the listeners about how you got involved and where the status of that case is right now?
So Brittany Drexel's case, it's a sad case. Like I said earlier in this interview, was from 2009. She was on vacation in Myrtle Beach and, you know, believed she was abducted and later killed. In that case, I did not get involved in the beginning. I was involved just in the last year or so. People that I have reached out to and have become friends with and have gained friendship along the way during my investigations brought me into Brittany's case. And subsequently, I was the director of investigations, as I stated, for Brittany's Little Angels, the nonprofit that her mother, Dawn, started. I didn't get too heavily involved in the case. Law enforcement and FBI are involved in that. And one thing that I wanted to state, when a private investigator gets involved in a case, if that case ever becomes criminal in nature, we then back out of the law enforcement side of it, and we stick to being an advocate for the family themselves. If you know who the law enforcement people are or they feel comfortable with you, they may let you stay in to a certain level. So with Brittany's case being at a federal level and being with federal investigators, I did not get close to the guts of that investigation whatsoever. I pretty much stayed on the nonprofit end of that for that family.
What was your impression in being involved? You aren't involved with it now, but while you were involved with it, what were your impressions of it? Do you think that's a case that's going to get solved? And what do you think about some of these suspects? Just once again, to your knowledge, I'm not asking you to, of course, divulge any secret information that you learned, you know, while you were working on the case or were you involved. What do you think about all that?
Well, in all honesty, I think the family did more of an investigation on that case than law enforcement did. Dawn is a very, she's very proactive. She's very headstrong when it comes to Brittany. As you can imagine, a mother-daughter bond is one that I would never go near and try to ever break or ever try to evaluate. But with that being said, yes, there are suspects out there that are publicly identified. And, you know, the Taylor family that's involved in the investigation, you know, I've looked at their backgrounds. Absolutely, they're capable of doing this. Absolutely, they're capable of doing the unspeakable to anybody. They're a well-known dirtbag family down in the South Carolina area. And, you know, do I think this case is going to be solved? I think it will be solved, and I think it's going to be solved in a manner that's, you know, it's going to come soon. I don't have a time frame on it, but based on my knowledge of everything, as much as persistence that the family is, this case is going to get solved. A lot of times when cases go this long, 9 years, I'm not saying Brittany's case, I'm saying, you know, you look for like a deathbed confession, or you look for, you know, a jailhouse snitch that finally just can't live with it anymore. Or sometimes you have some person out there that just can't live with it consciously and comes forward. I don't know what's going to solve the case in Brittany's situation, but I've seen it before where one of those three ends up solving the case. But I hope for the family, and I hope for Brittany herself, that, you know, she can rest in peace and that the family does get closure for her.
I have not followed Brittany's disappearance. There's been other ones over the last, let's say, 10 to 15 years that I think that I've personally followed a lot closer. But I have to tell you, when Raymond Moody came up as a suspect, he seemed like a good suspect in her case. Seemed like a very, very probable suspect. But then he kind of, it's interesting how if you watch these cases that go on for a long time, it's like one suspect pops up and he kind of fades away. Then another one pops up and he kind of fades away. So Raymond Moody pops up and then he is kind of faded away. And now recently, like you said, Sean and Deshaun Taylor, along with this informant Taquan Brown, who allegedly saw Brittany murdered, and then she was allegedly, and this is common knowledge, I'm not just divulging anything that's private, allegedly fed to alligators. To me, that sounds like a little bit of a crazy story, but I guess anything's possible.
Well, you know what, Ed, you said it best. It sounds like a crazy story, you're right. But when you're dealing with the mentality and the uneducated people we're dealing with here, I mean, all you have to do is listen to the interview and listen to them talk. That's something that somebody would do because it's easy. There's no organization involved in this. And that's what you deal with. When we conduct interviews, we look at people, we look at their body language, look at what they're doing. And we can easily say, this person's not educated. This person had a rough life. This person, you know, was abused or whatever the case may be. There's no excuse to go out and do the unthinkable. So in this particular situation, with the interview with Sean Taylor, that you could just tell right there that you're dealing with a non-educated person that very well could have thrown a body into an alligator pit, because that's as easy as somebody, the mentality you would think of.
And you would know more about that than I would, because you've dealt with these people over the years. I'm a reporter. You're actually a person. in law enforcement, private investigator, so you've had an opportunity to look at some of these people up and close and probably maybe a little too close in your liking sometimes.
Absolutely. And in this particular case, I did not meet with him, see him, talk to him. Mm-hmm. I've watched the interviews a few times, and I always look to see body language and things of that nature. And I think what type of attorney would turn around and represent somebody like this? And, you know, when you deal with these people, again, you have to have an open mind. Okay, they may not have done it, but you know what? I'm going to find out in the investigation what's going to tweak my mind and turn me whichever direction I'm going to turn. But keeping in the forefront, I'm going to go in the direction of the evidence. So with not having interviewed somebody personally, it's a little more difficult to draw judgment because you hear everybody else's judgment. And it's very easy to jump on the bandwagon. I try not to. I've done it, but I try not to. I like to do everything personally, like firsthand knowledge. And that's the results I deliver to my families, firsthand knowledge.
Let's move on to Crystal Morrison, her disappearance in Concord, North Carolina. What are the circumstances of that case, and how did you get involved with that one?
So I got involved in that one in November of 2012. Crystal's father was given my name by, as I stated earlier in the interview, Jake Ziegler's mother. When a family member goes missing or a loved one goes missing, other families tend to gravitate toward each other because you have that unfortunate common bond. So they developed a bond. And I was introduced that way. I flew to North Carolina when I got involved and met with Crystal's father. Very, very nice, very nice person. And again, same as I did the Amanda's case. Went through who Crystal was prior to her going missing. A son at the time was, I believe, 8 years old, which she went missing. Again, just tried to recap, what was going on at that point and what could have happened, what may have happened.
And what did happen on the day of her disappearance? What, she went to work and...
So Crystal she was off, I believe, the 2 days prior. She was out sick 2 days prior. And she had to go to work on that third day because she would have needed a doctor's note to be out of work. She arrived around the noon hour and shortly thereafter wasn't feeling well. And she called a friend of the family to come pick her up. And the friend of the family had arrived at her work approximately 25 to 30 minutes later, and Crystal had already left. And talking to her, other employees at her work, Crystal had gotten up after she made that phone call, grabbed her jacket, and walked out. Now, through further investigation, we talked to some more coworkers, and she was last seen by a coworker at the top of the driveway where she worked. And after that, nobody knows anything. It's like a bird picked her up and just took her somewhere, just completely just vanished.
You know, I have to tell you that that scenario right there, both for men and women in some of the cases I've covered, is very common, where it seems like somebody called somebody to come pick them up. That person gets there and they're gone. In fact, I just did the disappearance of Shane Fell, who disappeared in the state of Louisiana just a few years ago. The same circumstances. He had a wreck. He called his brother to come pick him up. His brother gets there. Shane's gone. Just completely gone. This sounds so much similar to Crystal's disappearance. Any theories in that? Where is the investigation going in that? That certainly does seem like vanish into thin air territory.
Yeah, it does. She did have an addiction problem prior to that. There's been theories that that she was still addicted at that point in time, and you know, maybe overdosed somewhere, maybe was abducted. Again, this is not a case where suicide or anything of that nature. She was a little bit older than your normal sex trafficking victim, so I tend to not even look in that direction. But again, like I said earlier, nothing's ever ruled out. But that case still remains open. She's still missing today. And obviously, as time goes on, you know, it's never good. But I think it'll get solved. I believe every case will be solved. It's just a question of when, how, and where.
In Crystal's case, has this friend who is going to pick her up been excluded from the investigation? Do you know?
Yeah, he's been excluded from the investigation. We know his whereabouts, things of that nature. She had a boyfriend at the time. Talked to him. You know, I actually personally spoke with him a few times, and you know, he seemed to be ruled out. No, but he wasn't not a person of interest. That's for sure. But like I said earlier, Ed, people are never actually ruled out. You know, unless we've got an alibi of where they're at, and even that. At some point, they can still be involved because you can orchestrate by phone or text to go do something to somebody. So
could hire somebody to go do it.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I want the listeners, like I said before, I'm sure most, if not all, are familiar with Brittany's disappearance, but I surely want the listeners to check out Crystal's disappearance, especially those of you who live in North Carolina and in the area where Crystal disappeared. She does have a page on charlieproject.org if you'd like to find out more information about that case if you've never heard of it before. As for you, Kevin, where is the rest of 2017 going to take you? And if anybody, any families, a lot of families who have missing loved ones listen to this program, if they want to get in contact with you, how can they do that?
Well, we'll see what 2017 holds. You know, I'm ready to help any families out that have a missing loved one, or they know a family that has a missing loved one. And I do a Facebook page. It's Kevin Ryan, Missing Person Investigator. My contact information's on there.
Right. I see the number. I'm on your page as we're speaking right now. And the phone number is 803-993-8477. If somebody wants to contact you.
Correct. And that goes directly to me. So, you know, I pick up every call, and, you know, if anybody needs help out there, please give us a call, and we'll do anything we can to help bring resolution to your case.
Now, I know that you're based on the East Coast. Do you do the entire United States, or just a particular area? Any restrictions on where you go and what you do?
Geographically, I mean, I like to say I cover the United States, but I always look into licensing issues because I'm licensed, and all my guys are licensed, my investigators are, so I just make sure that if it's another state that I haven't been in, I always make sure that we look up the licensing issues, because everything we do is of integrity and legal nature, so we would just have to go by what the law states.
Okay, fair enough. Like you said, listeners, you can find him on Facebook. He has a Facebook page, Kevin Ryan, Missing Person Investigator. The phone number is 803-993-8477. Kevin, any last words before we finish this interview?
No, I appreciate you having me on today. And, you know, hopefully we can bring awareness to the missing and, you know, bring some more people home. It's always a good feeling for the families and for us as investigators.
You're welcome. And I hope you'll keep me updated on Amanda's case. If there is any breaking news or any new developments, please let me know. I'll pass it along to the listeners, whether on the Unfound discussion group page or in the next episode that I'm going to do, which comes out every Friday. I hope you'll keep me posted on Amanda's case.
I sure will.
Okay.
I sure will, Ed.
Great. Thank you. And thank you for being on this episode of Unfound.
Thanks again for having me.
You're welcome.
And that was my interview with Kevin Ryan private investigator and representative for the DeGuio family. I thank him for being on the program, and I thank him for offering his opinions on the cases of Brittany Drexel and Crystal Morrison as well. In getting to cover all three cases all in one episode, you get to see a little bit of a contrast between Brittany's case, which has been featured everywhere, it seems, in the last 8 years, and Amanda's and Crystal's, which haven't gotten nearly as much attention. And the reason for this is simple. There's just not as much information out there about Amanda's and Crystal's disappearances. There's no videotapes. There's no suspects. Their disappearances are much like Jason Jolkowski's disappearance. He was walking to meet a coworker in a neighborhood, a nice neighborhood, just disappeared. It's kind of like what happened to Crystal and Amanda as well, although in their cases it seems like they did have some issues that they were fighting in their lives. Jason didn't have that. In the end, though, all of these cases have to be treated the same, and that's why I wanted to mix in a couple of these lesser-known cases, Amanda's and Crystal's, with Brittany's, which is very, very well-known. After interviewing Kevin, a few days after that, I had a chance to speak to Amanda's older sister, Nicole. We spoke for about 20 minutes, and I appreciate the time that she gave me. What I wanted to pass on to you from that conversation is that Amanda contracted her pill addiction much like many Americans have. She developed a painful condition, she was prescribed opioids, and the descent began there. So it's not like Amanda became an addict due to her wanting to have a good time. She wasn't a party girl. She was an unwitting victim, as most opioid abusers are. And it's clear to me that Amanda knew she needed to clean her act up. She didn't want to live the rest of her life the way she was. In fact, Amanda disappearing right after saying she wanted to change what she was doing is the part that I think confuses her family the most. Just when she acknowledges her problem, she disappears. You, the listeners, should know that I'm working on another case that is very similar to Amanda's. Another young woman has an addiction, wants to clean her act up, goes to detox, and she disappears right after that. You hear enough of these stories, and you start wondering if this is some sort of pattern, that it's not a coincidence, but it's actually something that's planned. Are these drug dealers abducting these young women, forcing them into sex trafficking, prostitution, or just outright murdering them because these women aren't going to be addicts anymore? I'm open to that theory. But with that, I'll leave the rest of the theorizing up to you. And that's the program. If you found it informative, please go to iTunes and give Unfound a 5-star review. I thank you for listening. Unfound will be returning to its regular format next week. I'm Ed Densel, and you've been listening to Unfound.